discontented and men who are dishonest. At the same time, he is talking about, in that story, Boule de Suif, what it meant to live under occupation. In other stories, he's talking what it means to be fearing you're going mad. So there's a wonderful story called Un Lâche, a coward, where the man has been challenged to a duel and he has this great sense of who he is. And he's so worried about not living up to the idea of being a brave man that he kills himself before dawn because he can't cope with it. So the incredible sophistication of the psychology, the strange blurred line, I suppose, between madness and sanity, the sense of a society under pressure, and everything that he writes about the occupation of the Franco-Prussian War could have been written from 1939 to 1944, because actually he was prescient of what France was going to be. So for me, he is both perfectly of his time and also an extraordinary seer.
He's occasionally attacked for misogyny, isn't he? You're the founder of the Orange Prize. Are you anxious about pinning your colours to his mast?
We are in the hands of the translators. So when I first read Maupassant, I would have said, you know, his view of women is pretty dodgy. You could also say his view of men is pretty dodgy. He's very misanthropic. But when you read a more modern translation, or indeed, of course, you read Maupassant in French, you discover that actually he has both an incredible contempt for cant and hypocrisy, but also incredible warmth for the real men and women who are making the stories. So I would say that if you read a more modern translation, the Sean Miles translation, for example, of A Parisian Affair and other stories, you would read a translation that is more akin to Maupassant, whereas some of the older ones possibly were slightly, they brought their own agenda to the table in the translation, and that is, I think, where a lot of his reputation for misogyny comes from.
This is a fiction, Maupassant's fiction, deals with a totally different stratum of French society compared with the Proust that we were talking about. I guess the aristocrats of Proust might not have allowed some of these characters into their houses, not through the front door, anyway.
No, you know, you might look quite hard in Proust for some of the characters who turn up in Maupassant. I'm very intrigued, though, by the shape of his stories, because you're talking about modernity, I think, when you're talking about the need for that bit of space between the writing and the reader, which right at the beginning, Kate, and I think that's absolutely there in Maupassant, and I absolutely love that too.
And he has a very modern, again, I suppose you could call framing device, which owes as much to Edgar Allan Poe and indeed Baudelaire, and certainly M.R. James and Algernon Blackwood, those Edwardian great ghost story writers of English tradition who were going to come a couple of years after Maupassant had died.
OK, well, as Baudelaire has entered the room, perhaps it's now time to hear Diana Quick read from his Twilight at Dawn.
Reveille was sounding in the barrack squares, and the morning wind was blowing on the lanterns. It was the hour when the swarm of malicious dreams makes brown boys twist and turn on their pillows. When, like a bloody eye throbbing and shifting, the lamp makes a red blur on the daylight. When the soul, beneath the weight of the reluctant, heavy body, imitates the struggling between the lamp and the daylight. Like a weeping face, dried by the breezes, the air is full of the shiver of fleeting things, and man is tired of writing, and woman of loving. The houses here and there were beginning to smoke. Women of pleasure, their eyelids bruised, their mouths open, were sleeping their stupid sleep. Female paupers, dragging their thin, cold breasts, were blowing on their embers and blowing on their fingers. It was the hour when, amid cold and miserliness, the pains of women in childbed grow worse. Like a sob cut off by foaming blood, the cry of the cock in the distance tore the misty air. A sea fog washed against the buildings, and the dying in the depths of the poorhouses were giving their death rattle and irregular gulps. The debauchees were heading home, broken by their labours. Dawn, shivering in a pink and green dress, was advancing slowly over the deserted Seine, and Sombre Paris, rubbing its eyes, was picking up its tools. A hard-working old man.
Thank you very much, Diana. Okay, well, Edmund, this is the city. This is the grubby and the urban here, isn't it?
This is the city as you would never have read it before. I mean, this is the first person, I think, to really take on the texture of the city. I mean, and absolutely bring it alive. This is modern life. And there's a sort of compassion there, which is quite extraordinary. And I don't think you find that before.
This person, this figure of the observer, Kate Moss, is given a name as well. This is the flâneur, isn't it? A tremendously important figure in French literature.
Yes, and I think what Edmund says is absolutely right, that Baudelaire is the most pivotal of the writers, because without him, almost nothing that came after, the Modin group, all of those people, it would have been very hard to contemplate. And it's also the moment at which there starts to be this beautiful marriage, not just between writers and artists, but between writers and composers. And it is a period where, because anything went in a funny sort of way, because of the great grief and depression of the Franco-Prussian War, the defeat, you know, the Prussians marching up the Champs-Élysées, the death of hope in the Commune, you suddenly had many young men, particularly, who felt liberated from their roles as soldiers, statesmen, and all the rest of it, and decided to devote themselves to art and being artists. And it does start with Baudelaire in the middle of the century, and him saying, this matters as much as anything else.
But the flâneur is quite a problematic sort of protagonist, isn't he? I mean, he's an observer. He doesn't get involved in the action quite, does he?
But that's what the modern city demands, you see. That's why Baudelaire gets it right about walking through the city, which is, how involved can you be? You walk down the great arcades, which are full of people, of the new goods and the things you can buy. You walk through these crowds, and what can you do except observe? So, in fact, and then describe, either as a poet or as a writer, or even bring it back to yourself and create some kind of artistic life at home. You know, be a dandy, be actually create some kind of aesthetic existence out of the way you live. So actually, flâneurs do matter enormously, and they, of course, lead ultimately to Proust as well.
OK, well, let's try and draw a few conclusions about what we've heard. Obviously, we've not attempted a great survey of French fiction, but I noticed that none of your choices have been from maybe that other tradition of French fiction, the rather more kind of violent and sensational sort, the Victor Hugo type of story. And I wonder what you think your choices that you've made might say about your own literary sensibilities, Edmund Navarre.
Oh, goodness me, that's a tough one. So where am I put on in the spectrum? I'm slightly flâneurial.
How exquisite are you?
I'm exquisite. I live with a few impressionists on my walls. Yeah, I think I put my hand up to all of that. I think that's exactly... You've got me nailed down completely. Miss out the Victor Hugo and put me on some beautiful apartment somewhere in Paris, preferably the turn of the century, and I'm extremely happy. And that's just fine.
Kate Moss.
I would say that with Maupassant, actually, there is the violence there. Whether it's sort of like Les Tombales, which is the woman who's in the graveyard looking for rich men for pickings, or La Ola, which many of you all know, which is the most appalling sort of psychological weirdness. And Baudelaire, of course, learned English specifically to translate Edgar Allan Poe. That was why he learned English, it's said. So I think that Gothic is always there under the surface in all of that literature, actually.
All right, well, here the guillotine has to fall down on this conversation. So everybody please put down your knitting and let's thank my guests here at the Royal College of Music, Kate Moss, Edmund Navarre and Diana Quick. Thank you all.
Well, Matthew Sweet was talking to Kate Moss and Edmund Navarre. The reader was Diana Quick, and the next Proms Plus Literary event will be on Wednesday evening when Peggy Reynolds will be exploring the cello in literature with Rana Mitter. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the Proms. I'm Rob Cowan. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's Prom, which is devoted to just one work, Beethoven's Concerto in C, Opus 56, for violin, cello and piano, popularly known as the Triple Concerto. Beethoven first thought of composing a concerto for these particular forces in early 1802, possibly with his young piano student, the Archduke Rudolf, in mind. But whatever the genesis of this triple concerto, what's for sure is that it inhabits a bright, confident world, and while rarely plumbing the depths in the way that, say, the fourth piano concerto does, it nonetheless has real scale. Tonight's trio of soloists are the Capucin brothers, violinist Renaud and cellist Gautier, and the pianist Franck Braly, all of them making their proms debut, playing here for the very first time. I met up with them earlier on and asked them what challenges the work presents.
The difficulty of this piece, like the Brahms double concerto, but probably even more with a Beethoven triple, you need to find the right balance between the three instruments as a trio and as one voice.
And to find a character too, because this kind of lightness, this concerto, especially the first movement, can be a bit heavy or sticky, and we have to find this kind of lightness and
elegance.
Elegance of C major, and also the spirit of the polacca. So it's kind of tricky concerto to find the right balance, the right spirit, and it's unusual Beethoven.
And I would add it's a non-ego concerto. If you have three egos playing together, it just doesn't work. And it's, I guess, why it is so often played, and okay played, but not together played. You know what I mean? Like, everybody's trying to take the cover, and really often when you hear it with Swiss soloists, like big names, it's quite rare that it really works, because you can't just play as a concerto. You have to play, like, chamber music inside a concerto. And this is why it is such an interesting and special piece, I guess.
Well, Tom Service on his Guardian blog speaks about a very famous recording where big names are involved, Richter, Rostropovich and Oistrakh, with Karajan conducting. But the great piano trios have made the best recordings, the Beaux-Arts trio, the Oistrakh trio and the Stern-Roses Stowman. And, of course, tonight's lineup are going to be marvellous. They play chamber music together. The Capucins have recorded all the Beethoven violin sonatas to wonderful effect. And if the rehearsal this morning is anything to go by, then we certainly are in for a treat. In fact, when I say rehearsal, it was really a playthrough of the performance. There was very little to correct. The balance was so perfect with the orchestra that really there was nothing to... There was nothing to put right. Beautiful music making. Chamber music on a large scale, I'd say. Which is precisely what this music needs. Well, here they are now. A formidable and highly talented trio, if ever there was one, with the Orchestra Philharmonique de Radio France under Myung-Woon Chung to perform Beethoven's triple concerto. Well, as if that polonaise ending isn't exciting enough, off Beethoven flies with that high-speed coda, brilliantly played there by the brothers, the violinist Renaud Capuçon, the cellist Gaultier Capuçon, and the pianist Franck Royaly, with the Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France, conducted by Myung-Woon Chung. The two brothers there communing in music, much as they do in life. They're great friends, and they're both recently fathers as well, they told me when I spoke to them earlier on today. I love the honesty and the directness of their playing, and Franck Royaly is a real soulmate. It's such an integrated trio, and here they come again. Myung-Woon Chung stands back to let them bask in this applause, so well deserved. And they applaud the orchestra, who now stand. Well, back. We'll be back tomorrow with Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France under Myung-Woon Chung, with Weber's Oberon Overture, Brahms' Double Concerto, and Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring. That's at 7 p.m. But now, time to hand you back to Ian Skelly and the rest of the evening on Radio 3.
Rob, thank you very much indeed. Rob Cowan, live at the Royal Albert Hall for us tonight at the BBC Proms. Don't forget that there are a couple of ways to hear that prom again if you'd like to. It'll be here on the wireless on Wednesday afternoon this week during one of our afternoon proms repeat programmes. That's at 2 o'clock this Wednesday. Or if you prefer, you can listen again to it on the Radio 3 website any time of the day or night for the next 7 days. Tomorrow afternoon, by the way, you can hear the prom that appeared on Sunday night. And it was quite a night. The soprano Susan Gritton, the mezzo Christine Rice, the tenor Peter Orty, and the bass Alistair Miles joined, wait for it, the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra Youth Chorus, the Eltham College Boys Choir, the Southend Boys and Girls Choir, the BBC National Chorus of Wales, the Huddersfield Choral Society, the London Symphony Chorus, and also the Welsh Choir Cor Cerdeth. Hardly room for the audience, I imagine. On the platform, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales was conducted by Martin Brabbins, and they were all there to perform Havergal Brian's first symphony, the so-called Gothic Symphony. That's 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. Well, as Rob mentioned, Brahms is on the bill tomorrow night, his concerto for violin and cello, and I thought we could now hear some Brahms next this evening before the Liebrecht interview tonight. This is an early piece by Brahms, composed in difficult years for him as he struggled to overcome what he felt were the limitations of his compositional style, and as he battled to improve them, he poured out many a small instrumental piece, many of them juggling with the lessons that he'd learnt from the earlier masters like Bach and Handel. So you'll hear a baroque-like contrabuntal theme to begin, followed by 11 variations in all here. They begin quietly, but soon lift off into a more energetic pace before returning rather majestically to the original theme at the end. This theme and variations is played by Garrick Olson. Thank you. That was Garrick Olson playing a set of variations on an original theme by Brahms, the first of a set of two, Opus 21, as he sought to learn from the great masters of the past. And there's plenty more Brahms on the menu at the BBC Proms tomorrow night here on Radio 3. You can hear the double concerto by Brahms, a meltingly beautiful piece played by tonight's soloists, in fact, Gautier and Renaud Capuçon. And after the interval, a piece of music that swept away a great deal of what Brahms believed in, the crack of life as the spring dawns on a Russian landscape. Stravinsky's primal Rite of Spring. You can hear that prom given by tonight's orchestra, the Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France, live here on BBC Radio 3, beginning at 7 o'clock. An earlier start time because we'll be back at the Royal Albert Hall for 10 tomorrow night for the first of this season's late proms. The Belcher Quartet will be joined by the cellist Valentin Erben to play Schubert's string quintet composed in the last months of his life. Music that shifts its mood from one moment to the next, and no doubt its rather ethereal middle movement will work particularly well with a late night audience. No doubt some of the promenaders lying on the floor staring into the dome above them as they listen to the music. Well, we'll be there, and you too can lie on the floor listening if you like by joining us for that late night prom at 10 o'clock tomorrow night here on BBC Radio 3. Well, next tonight we're going to meet Semyon Bychkov in an extended interview with Norman de Brecht. But before we leave the proms, a look ahead to a big event coming soon.
On BBC Radio 3 from the 2011 proms, a musical celebration of a great television event. Earlier this year, Human Planet brought to our screens some of the diverse cultures of the world with a musical soundtrack by Nitin Sawhney.
It was inspired by these incredible images, and I think if you write music that's inspired by incredible visuals, inevitably the music works in itself.
You can hear excerpts from Nitin Sawhney's score and also some of the performers heard in Radio 3's accompanying Music Planet series. A memorable Saturday night at the BBC Proms on BBC Radio 3 from 7:30.
This is BBC Radio 3, and yes, it's time now for the first in a new series of the Le Brecht interview, where the writer and broadcaster Norman Le Brecht talks to leading figures in the musical world. So for the next three quarters of an hour, it's over to Norman Le Brecht.
Semyon Bychkov has become one of the world's most sought-after conductors by the scenic route. Rather than competing for trophy positions in major capitals, he rose from orchestras in Grand Rapids, Michigan, to Buffalo, before negotiating some crazy paving at the Orchestre Paris, then to Semperoper Dresden, and finally to the Radio Orchestra in Cologne, all the while acquiring a quiet fame for the refinement and power of his performances. He is the least well-known of leading maestros. Nearing 60, Bychkov has given up the last of his salaried jobs to pick and choose his diary dates. He's a regular at the BBC Proms, taking two of this summer's prime concerts, Verdi's Requiem and Mahler's Sixth Symphony. Born in Russia, finishing his education in the United States, he's married to the duo pianist Maria Labeck and had a brother, Yakov Kreitzberg, a much-loved conductor who died earlier this year. We meet in Paris, in the studios of Radio France. Semyon Bychkov, you can't get away from music. At work, at home, in summer, you've described yourself as obsessive. Is there a part of yourself that you hold separate from music?
No, not that I'm aware of. Why should I? It is my life.
It's everything?
It's everything, of course.
You wake up in the morning and it's music and you go to sleep at night? And
yes, and I think while I'm sleeping, I still have music in me. But, you know, it is not something that is separate from me. Mm-hmm. It is me. And I think it is true to every musician. I don't know a single musician who is not becoming music when making music or when thinking about music. It is just part of the air we breathe.
Always from your earliest memory?
Yes.
What was that memory?
That memory, I'm not sure that I know exactly the day of the week when suddenly it occurred to me that there is such thing that is called music. But when I was 5 years old, my mother took me to a house of scientists, which was a sort of club, if you wish, of scientists in Leningrad, which is today, again, St. Petersburg. My father, being a scientist, was a member of it. And so she wanted to know whether I had a musical talents as much as one can judge someone at 5 years of age. She herself played piano in her youth before the war started, after which it was all interrupted. And so, but she loved music very much. So she took me to this house of scientists, and I was diagnosed as having what is called absolute pitch, which is a capacity to identify notes and a basic sense of rhythm. So those kind of things that one can say that a child would possess. And then I started my piano lessons, and ever since it was only music.
Did your mother play at home?
No, by that time she did not play piano anymore.
Did you have a piano? You had the whole family in one room.
Yes, she rented a piano at the time when I was accepted in that piano class at the House of Scientists. So I had an instrument. It was not ours, but I had a small piano to practice on at home. And she was sitting next to me and was sort of following my practicing. And so, yes, in that sense, she was quite present at that moment.
Did you think at the time this was quite a deprived beginning? You were living in one room, you shared a bathroom with four other families. It was just how people lived in Leningrad in the 1950s.
Not all people lived like this, but this is how we lived, and I didn't know any better, and so it was normal.
Your father was a scientist in the army. Why didn't he get the privileges that went with that job?
Well, actually, not everybody was getting privileges fast enough. And one of the privileges that he had was that in the early 60s, he was actually sent by the army to Kazakhstan, where lots of experiments and testing went on. And he was, in fact, a military man only because he belonged to the army, but he was, in fact, a scientist. And so he was sent to Kazakhstan. So from that moment on, we remained in Leningrad. And so he lived very far away, and we would see each other several times during the year, usually when he would have a vacation. And so it was normal to have a small room with a whole family living there and sharing it with other neighbors. Each one would have a room of their own and a common kitchen. That's what was called communal apartments. And it's pretty amazing because, you know, man gets used to everything. And so you get used to the idea that, okay, you cannot have a silence. Someone will be discussing whatever there is to discuss. Someone else will be practicing piano. You're trying to do your math homework and whatever. So you, in a way, get used to creating your own world of concentration where you are so fixated on the subject at hand that you are not disturbed by things that are going on around you. So I never felt myself deprived. Not at all.
And is that a useful skill in rehearsal, that concentration?
Concentration, focus? I think, is something that is indispensable in anything we do, whether it is rehearsal, whatever activity one has. Whatever you do, you have to concentrate on it. And therefore, you will have the greatest advantage in the, let's say you want to achieve something, you will have the greatest result possible only if there is absolute concentration at that particular moment. Once you've done it, you go on to something else, but then you will have to have concentration for that thing. So it is. I think it's just a wonderful training of being able to concentrate in circumstances that may not necessarily be considered as wonderfully luxurious.
You went to the Glinka Academy at 7, yes. And then to the Rimsky-Korsakov Conservatory.
Yes.
To study with
Ilya Musin.
Did you choose him? Did he choose you? There was Rabinovich as well, who was the other teacher. Did you know which one to go to?
Well, they were two great, great, great gurus, Rabinovich and Musin. They were actually wonderful friends. They had tremendous affection for each other, enormous respect. And so those two were rather gigantic personalities on the conducting paysage of not only Leningrad, but basically in the country, because it was that school in Leningrad that was viewed as the kind of mecca to go and study conducting. This is what one wants to do. Now, your question whether I chose Musin or he chose me, first I chose him and after that he chose me, otherwise I wouldn't have been there.
Did you also sit in on Rabinovich? On his classes?
Yes, you see, it was so normal for us, so natural. We were sitting in everybody else's class. There were plenty of chairs. People were sitting and observing. And those were conducting students of the professor himself. Also pianists, composers, theory majors, even singers who would come to observe. Because it isn't only about conducting, finally. It is about view on music. It is about what music represents and whether you're a conductor or a violinist. only the instrument of expression changes. The search for expression is essentially the same. And so, yes, it was there that sometimes you would hear very astonishing things. A lot of the time it was very enlightening because you would hear those men who devoted their life to music, to thinking about it, reflecting on it, coming often to the same conclusion from completely different directions. There was a lot of polarity of opinions, a lot of discussion between professors and also between the students. And the amount of arguments that went on have absolutely nothing to do with the kind of totalitarian system that we were living in. That was another subject.
So it was a kind of refuge from the system. Once you came into the conservatory, you could close the door behind you and the system stayed
out
of the classroom.
No, you could not, because in the next hour you would find yourself in a classroom where Marxist-Leninist aesthetics were taught. And, of course, no one that I knew was the slightest bit of interested in it. But nevertheless, it was part of what one had to attend and an exam that had to be taken and somehow passed. It was basically, it was something everyone was laughing at quietly, but everyone had to do. There was no refuge in music, so to speak, because the reality of life and the reality of the system in which people lived was what it was. But music was stronger than any ideology. So that was the atmosphere in which we grew up.
You stood out quite quickly from the class. You won the Rachmaninoff conducting competition in 1973, which was a big thing, and that should have given you a debut with the Leningrad Philharmonic. That was the prize. What
yes.
happened?
Yes.
Didn't happen.
No, it did not happen. It did not happen twice.
That's a very good double non-happening. What happened?
The very first time I was invited after I won the Rachmaninoff conducting competition, and that was in 1973, I was invited to make my debut with the Leningrad Philharmonic Orchestra, which was unheard of for someone who was only 20 years old. And so Musin told me very quietly, he said, you know, I would advise you just to ask them to postpone your debut, because at the moment you could come under severe pressure and criticism. Just in case would be better to avoid. And so my debut was postponed. And 1 year later, they called me again. They said, we would like to do your debut. And it will take place on the 28th September 1974. By then, I would be in my fifth and final year at the conservatory. And so it was. And then I started getting in trouble with the authorities because my views on the system in which we lived and the ideology that was strongly imposed on us, my views became known.
How did you get into trouble?
It's very simple. It's enough for you to say something that you shouldn't say and for someone to hear it and report it.
Do you know what it was?
Do
you know who it was?
I know very well who it was. I know very well who were the people who reported my views to the authorities.
That musicians?
Yes, they were. Yeah.
And the views that they reported?
That I was politically unreliable.
In what respect?
Well, that I did not consider the dogma which we were taught, I did not really believe it. That the dogma was we lived in the best possible world.
But nobody believed it.
Yes, but you shouldn't
say
it.
They would have had to expel everyone.
But you shouldn't say it.
Ah.
You see, that's the difference. Right. As long as you don't say it, you can think what you want, but you should not say it. And if you only say that that's what you believe and you don't say it, you only believe it, you still shouldn't believe it because you shouldn't think it. But as long as you don't say that you're thinking it, it's all right.
So what made you say it?
Well,
you knew the risk.
Well,
you were young, you were impetuous, but you knew the risk.
Well, you know, I don't believe that one should accept living a lie. It's just that simple. You know, I think there is no harm in saying what you think. I mean, it's not a question of being reckless. It's just a very simple reality of life. I lived it very closely, watching my father, who was a great scientist, who, when he got out of the army and became a retired officer in reserve and wanted to, and still could, because he was still very young, get a job in one of the scientific institutions, one after the other refused him because they already had their quota of Jewish scientists filled and maybe fulfilled. And so even though they needed him and they wanted him, they couldn't take him. So imagine you live and you see your father during a whole year, going every day, looking for work and coming back and saying that, well, yeah, didn't work out. And again, didn't work out. It affects you because you realize that basically when the propaganda tells you that you live in a very just society where everyone is equal, the reality isn't so, in any case, not for everybody. It makes you think. So as a teenager, it became absolutely obvious to me that the reality and what we were led to believe did not really connect. And so you just say sometimes what you think, you can say it privately, which is what I did, but it became known to the authorities that I was not politically reliable.
So the concert was canceled?
The concert was first postponed from 28th September 1974 until 4th November 1974.
In the hope that you might become reliable in 6 weeks?
No, it was, I think, a way of trying to soften the blow. Because even though it was a very totalitarian society, it was a very complex society. Not everyone, certainly majority of the people were not informants of the KGB. Majority of people were decent. Majority of people did recognize that it would be very unjust to punish someone only because of what he happens to believe in. You know, and so I think that they genuinely wanted to soften the blow. And first they said the concert needs to be postponed. And of course, I knew very well that the writing on the wall was absolutely clear. So I knew that it's going to be trouble. And there were plenty of signs that were clear to me that the doors were really closing very gradually, just about everywhere. And then 1 week before the second date, I was finally told that the concert cannot take place, should not take place. And from that point, it was absolutely clear that I really don't have much of a future there. So then I migrated.
You applied for exit visa?
Yes.
Any difficulty?
Well, the difficulty, of course, is that you immediately become a person that people are afraid to have a contact with, a lot of people. So you sort of, at first, find yourself a little bit in a vacuum, but then suddenly turn up to be the real friends who approve of your decision. And suddenly you become close with people that before you didn't really even know. So, yes, it is not an easy process, and especially because you take a great risk of asking an exit visa without having any guarantee that you would be allowed to leave. You cannot work anymore. There was absolutely no guarantee that I would be able to leave the country.
You were not allowed to graduate?
Actually, I was expelled from conservatory the moment I applied for exit visa, and that was 4 months before my graduation. So 30 days later, after I have presented my papers with an application, a telephone call rang in the house with an invitation to appear the day after at the KGB office that was dealing with these matters. It was a Thursday, and so I was supposed to appear there on Friday to come and hear the verdict. It was very well known that Friday at 4 p.m. was the time when those who would be called in would be refused an exit visa. And so I went there knowing perfectly well that I will be refused. And of course they gave you 24 hours to get used to the idea that you will be refused. And so there were about 9 families that day that were called in. And one after the other went inside the reception, came out, and it was clear that the result was not exactly a very cheerful one for them. So finally my name was called. I went in, and there were 2 officers sitting around a table with a big cassette recorder running and recording every word that I might possibly say. And of course, I was not saying anything. I was waiting. And so the man had my dossier right under his nose, and he said, so your application has been considered, and it has been decided to, and then he started turning pages as if he didn't know what the verdict was. It was decided to allow you to emigrate. Now, here I was pretty shocked because I came for a completely different answer, and here it is. And so the first question, and the only one I had the presence of mind to ask, is that, what am I supposed to do now? And they burst out laughing because the question was so idiotic.
And so you got out.
And three weeks later, I was gone.
But your father couldn't leave. Your father, they wouldn't get a visa.
No, he was refused for 12 years. And it was only when Gorbachev came to power and perestroika had begun that finally he was called in and told that he could go if he so wished. And so he emigrated and came to America and eventually lived his last 8 years of his life in France.
You flew out to Vienna?
Yes.
With your first wife?
Yes.
And what happened? I mean, you didn't know anybody? You just got off the plane in Vienna and...
With
a young wife?
Yes, and just like that.
How much money did you have in your pocket?
$100. That was all that we were allowed to take. And even if we were allowed to take more, we were too poor to have to have more than that. So, but we were met by the representatives of the HIAS, which is a Jewish agency that supports refugees. They asked us where we wanted to go, and we said that we would like to go to America. They said, okay, come with us. And so we spent 10 days in Vienna.
Any music?
Not very directly. However, about second evening after our arrival, I was walking on the streets and somehow found myself in front of the Staatsoper. And I see a poster which says Lohengrin, premiere, new production, conducted by Zubin Mehta. And so I was watching people going in. Of course, I couldn't get in. I was just watching. And finally, I could see that the doors were closed, the lights went down, the performance had begun, and I walked away. That is 1975. Exactly 30 years later, there was a poster of a new Lohengrin production, and my name was on it. And during the final rehearsal, I told the Vienna Philharmonic, which of course is the orchestra of the Vienna State Opera, I said, 30 years ago, there was a young man who was standing just outside of the doors watching people go in to hear Lohengrin conducted by Zubin. And that man was me. So here we are, except I'm inside. And so it was one little memento of my music in Vienna. And then 10 days later, we were taken to Italy and spent 6 months in Rome, waiting for the American papers. Mm-hmm. And so those were extraordinary 6 months of living in the free world. It was a fantastic cushion before going to America and starting new life.
There were one or two other Russian friends, Vitaly Margulis.
Margulis, yes, had become a very, 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 yes, yes. This was an extraordinary person. He was a wonderful pianist. He was more than a pianist. Piano was just an instrument of expression. And from him, I have received one of the greatest lessons in my life. He was a professor of Leningrad Conservatory. He could have been my father by age. And in Rome, we became very close. And one day, he was invited to go to Germany, to Freiburg, to give masterclass and a recital, as a result of which he was offered professorship. He was the first one of us who actually had a concrete, specific future, not only a dream of one. And so he came back to Rome on the train. I was at the train station, as many of us were there, greeting him like a hero. And so after hugs and kisses and congratulations, he announced that that evening there will be a party in the flat that he was renting. And so, of course, we were all invited. And I was, for some reason, late. And so by the time I came, the party was well on, and everybody was very joyful. It was a terrific atmosphere. The only thing was that I was told that he was waiting for me because he was planning to offer me some money. So I was prepared for trouble. And so after I had my chance to drink some wine and to eat some pasta, he said, you know, let's go to the next room. I'd like to tell you how it went to Germany. So, of course, we went, and he started telling me how the masterclass went, how the recital went, how warmly he was greeted by the Germans. So he was telling me all this. And finally, he said, you know, I made a little bit of money. I think he made about $500. I think that was the fee that he received. He said, I would like to share it with you. He offered me $20, and I didn't want to take it. I felt extremely uncomfortable. He kept arguing and trying to convince me, and I kept refusing. And then I saw that he had tears in his eyes. And he said, you know, I was successful now, and I was very fortunate, and I would like to share it with you. And I really want you to accept it. One day there will be someone who will need your help. And by helping that person, you will return this debt to me. And that was one of the greatest lessons I have ever learned.
So from Rome, Margulis, you reach America.
Yes.
Manus College, free scholarship. And then you went on to the first American orchestras, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Buffalo, upstate New York, both
pretty formidable orchestras, but not major league. You didn't stay around to wait for a major league orchestra. You didn't actually see yourself as staying in America, or did you? What happened there?
You know, I never had a game plan because I don't view life as a game. And what I'm interested in planning is programs, for example, planning projects. Those are not plans, they're dreams. So you want to realize them. But they are not attached to a specific career situation or specific standing in a profession. Career is only a reflection. It's like a mirror. It reflects what you do. And nothing else, and nothing more. To run after the mirror is idiotic. At that time, it was exactly the same as it is today. I was fortunate enough to have these opportunities of being invited to conduct Grand Rapids Symphony, which was a regional orchestra consisting of young musicians. They were in search of music director. So it was a luck, it was a privilege, and the only thing that I wanted out of this for myself is opportunity to conduct the repertoire that I want to program, to learn the administration that needs to be learned. And in spite of the objection of people who were representing me professionally at that time, who said that it's not a good idea because you will typecast yourself as a minor orchestra conductor. And I said, I need to know everything about the problems this kind of orchestra will have, because the same type of problems, I'm absolutely sure, exist in the greatest orchestras in the world. Only the budget will be different. The quality of music making will be higher. The tradition will be more pronounced. But the challenges will be the same.
Semyon, you must be the only person in history who's had a call in Grand Rapids, Michigan, to come and conduct the Berlin Philharmonic.
Well, it happened.
It sounds as though you were right.
It so happened. But
and then Herbert von Karajan almost wrecked your career by saying that you might be his successor.
First of all, he never said it like this.
Ah, okay.
No, he never said it like this. He was asked often in the final phase of his life who he could see as his successor. In that particular interview, in that particular moment, I was on his mind because we have met very recently. It was after my second performance with the second trip in Berlin when Jochum has cancelled. The first one was Riccardo Muti who cancelled.
So this, you were commuting from Grand Rapids to Berlin.
No, I would not call it a commute. But at that time, Karajan, in fact, was editing his video just as I arrived. And I sat next to him while he was editing his film, and there were few minutes of his activity followed by very tedious waiting for the technical work to be done, which, of course, he was not involved in. And during the time, we talked for several hours, and I had plenty of questions to ask him, and that's what he loved. And he wanted to know what I'm doing, where I am. So I told him, I said, I'm in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is sort of like your Ulm. And he laughed and he said, you're absolutely right. A few years of that and you're ready for anything. That was that meeting. And then some months later came out the interview in which he was, as always, asked the question. And he mentioned me as one of his possible successors. It was simply a way of showing approval for what he saw in his meeting with me. He approved of the way in which I thought about music and how I wanted to go about it. That was it. And so when you say that he nearly wrecked my career, well, I'm still here. Am I not? I'm talking to you. Why? Maybe there must be a reason why you wanted to talk to me. So he never wrecked my career.
No. But he gave you some turbulence at the time because there was an overestimation.
A turbulence comes regardless. Mm. It's only a question what it will come from and where. But if I ever had a choice of choosing between his approval or the approval of those who hated him, I think the answer is very clear. And so, for me, it's simply a privilege.
The reason we're here in Paris is because the next job you took was Orchestre de Paris.
Yes.
For 10 years.
Yes.
And that was even more turbulent.
Of course.
You had a tough time with that orchestra.
Very.
What was it? Was it a difference of background, difference of mentality, difference of culture?
Everything. You know, how many people go through a bad marriage in life? I think lots of people you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a bad marriage.
For 10 years?
9 years.
9 years. Yes. And it was bad from the beginning?
Soon after, yes. Yes. Well, you just mentioned the things, you know, it is basic incompatibility.
Incompatibility.
And so with marriage, there is always a big decision to make. Are you going to stay together and try to make it work? or you don't. Well, for 9 years we tried to make it work, and it didn't. And then it came to an end. And that's all there is to it.
That didn't depress you?
Of course
it
did.
That constant struggle?
Of course it did. Of course it did. Naturally.
Was there a specific point of conflict, or was it just general resistance to one another?
Yeah, I guess that was a general resistance, but there were specific things that would happen here and there where there would be a disagreement about how we want to live our life together. And it isn't to say that I was an angel and they were villains. It isn't to say that they were angels and I was a villain. It was just basic incompatibility. Mm-hmm. You know, those things, like in marriage, they work or they don't. They're called chemistry, human chemistry. And it's impossible to explain. You find it, in fact, inside any collective. It's the same as a soccer team. Manchester United will not get into the final of the Champions League if they really cannot stand each other and don't want to play together. We all know this. It's the same with a symphony orchestra. And then there are other orchestras where, for some reasons, people who somehow are brought there by destiny to be together don't really enjoy being with each other. And then they don't play very well. And then everyone who is there is going to be suffering, whether it is a member of the orchestra or a member of administration or a conductor. It just doesn't work. And it is a part of life.
You were, by this time, performing with many of the great orchestras, and then you moved on to the Semper Oper in Dresden, and from there to the Radio Orchestra in Cologne. Is there, do you think, a Bychkov effect that you have on orchestras? Is there something between you and an orchestra that is personal to you?
Yes. For me, everything is personal.
Okay. Can you put your finger on what it is that you do with an orchestra?
You know, the idea of 100 or more colleagues making music together, in fact, is exactly the same as two people playing chamber music. It's just more complex because there are more personalities involved. But the task is exactly the same, integration. It means that for those who play piano, know that you have 10 fingers and you will have, for example, 10 notes played at the same time. What do you want to do with these 10 notes? You want to make sure they're well balanced. That the notes, as they evolve at the right time, in the right place. In a way, it's a matter of organizing the texture, organizing the flow of the music. And of course, if one person does it, it's between you and your instrument. But if two people do it, it's already between two individuals and two instruments. And if 100 people do it, it's become even more complex. Now, musicians of the orchestra, they, for the most part, do not study the full score the way a conductor has to. They have their own part. And if they're very familiar with a piece, because they have played it many times, they know a lot of what the colleagues are playing. But most of the time, not everything, because they can't hear everything while they're playing themselves. And so what I must do is to offer them first a vision of the piece, how I would like it to go in a very general way. And so we play it. They're offering me their vision of the piece, which is, of course, multiplied by 100, let's say. And then during the time that we will spend together, it's for me also to make sure that they hear the score in the way in which I hear it. So they know that at this moment I'm playing my violin, but it's the second bassoon that needs to be heard, that needs to come out. And then 2 seconds later, going from the second bassoon, it travels, for example, to a third clarinet. Again, everyone needs to know, it's that colleague that needs to have space.
And so, you are the facilitator here.
I'm a facilitator, and I'm bringing their attention to it, to the needs of each one of them, so that everyone has to feel completely integrated. You cannot be integrated if you don't know what the colleagues are doing.
You're describing it almost in psychoanalytic terms.
Well, it is.
To enable each of them to achieve the best of themselves.
Yes, but isn't what everyone wants to do in life to fulfill oneself?
Yes.
To find a fulfillment. I think this is the dream of every individual.
And this is what you bring.
And an integration, because you're not doing it by yourself. You do it with other people, which means integrating with them, giving them the space when they need it, and receiving it from them when you need it. It's as simple as that to explain. To do it, of course, requires time and a dedication. But dedication is usually there when people believe in what they're doing.
Can we talk a little bit about your brother Yakov? He changed his name to Kreutzberg before starting a conducting career so that there should be no confusion between the two of you. He said that you asked him to change the name.
No, of course not. You cannot ask someone to change the name. No one has the right to do that.
Okay. Was there a fear in your mind that there would be a confusion between you?
No. If there would be confusion, it would be for him in a way, because he was coming after me. He was 7 years younger. Mm-hmm. I was already professionally advanced when he was still studying conducting. And years later, it could become more difficult for him. But it was not for me to ask him. You see, I was not in any way threatened. I am not threatened by anyone, and certainly not by my own brother. So it's not something I would ever ask him or anyone else to do.
The first time I met him in Glyndebourne, where he conducted a tremendous Yanufa and Katya, he said there were difficulties between you and you weren't speaking. Were they ever resolved?
No, they were not resolved.
You never spoke again?
No, and it is a source of sadness, which I think everyone can understand, but I don't think it's something that I want to discuss, because it remains inside the family, and those things I think happen in lots of families.
Of course. Did you reach out?
Yes, I did.
Bychkov's Wagner, from what I've heard of it, is powerful, detailed, and carefully unpolitical. Everything seems to hinge on the psychology of characters, the alienation of Tannhäuser, the self-hatred of Ortrud in Lohengrin, the Tristan und Isolde with Bill Viola about the impossibility of love. Is that conscious interpretation of your part that you...
No, it's not conscious, that it's not political. That part is not conscious. Now that you're mentioning it, actually, I think it's a compliment.
And I tell you why.
Because I know very well that certain characters that have affected the history and destiny of humanity in the way in which someone like Stalin or Hitler affected it to an extreme, well, they have used music in order to propagate the kind of ideas that they wanted humanity to subscribe to, in any case to obey by. That is most objectionable. So I'm not there to use music to prove an ideology or to prove any political point. Music for me is an expression of life. It's an expression of human destiny. It's an expression of human condition.
And personality.
Of course. And the motivation of those characters that make Kundry do what she does. Ortrud act in the way in which she does. Lohengrin, who looks for absolute love without any conditions attached, etc., etc. So that's what really interests me, not a political... Of course there are...
Is the political in Wagner untouchable? Do you put that to one side when you conduct Wagner? The anti-Semitism, the proto-fascism?
You know, the last thing that could ever cross my mind, because it never did, is how abhorrent those views of Wagner, for example, on Jewish people, were and continue to be while conducting his music. Because this is the paradox, it's a supreme paradox. How is it possible for someone able to create from nothing, to conceive those phenomenal sounds that affect so many of us in the way in which they do, that transport us into another state of being, that make us forget ourselves, which is a moment de grâce, as the French people would call it. How is it possible for someone also to have this kind of views? Well, I'm very fortunate that the power of the music is such when I conducted that it would never occur to me to think about the other side of Wagner. I will think about it while I'm not conducting his music, because I'm not immune to it. I'm as affected by it as every thinking and decent human being. But the power of music is so much stronger than that, that I think it's even stronger than he himself was, that fortunately it does not affect me while I'm making this music, and I cannot live without it. I have to have this music in my life. Not all the time, but I have to have it, just as I need to have Shostakovich, just as I need to have Bach, and all of those great composers. All of them were human beings. All of them had flaws, some to an extreme,
Where do you stand on Shostakovich? You saw him around the concert halls, the conservatories in Leningrad. Was he anti-Soviet? Was he a brave resistant? Or was he just a musician trying to get along?
I'm not sure it's very easy to define bravery. Bravery can be defined, I think, in many different ways. There is a brave person who will try to blow up a building as a sign of protest. It takes courage to do that. Whatever the motivation, one doesn't have to agree with motivation, but one has to accept the idea that it takes courage or madness, act of madness. Okay, Shostakovich was not that person. Shostakovich was a man who was frightened. And considering what he lived through, it's very easy to understand why he would be frightened. Ever since he was condemned in that villainous article in Pravda, which represented the point of view of Stalin, even if it was not signed by his name, ever since that time, and considering
January
what was
1936.
Yes, and considering what was happening in those years in Russia, where people were disappearing every day in droves, never to be seen or heard from again, it's understandable why he would be frightened. The courage and the bravery, I think, come from the fact of the kind of music that he was able to compose, which required bravery and courage, because he had to find a way to express his condition and condition of his people in the language that was acceptable to the authorities, and at the same time to deliver the message as he had delivered. And that is, for me, an act of great courage and great bravery. So what one says and what one does in this kind of society is not always the same thing, and who are we to judge?
That's the greatest heroism to overcome fear.
Yes.
Talking to people who work with you, agents, singers, orchestral musicians, they say Semyon's one of the most organized individuals on earth, knows exactly what he wants, concerns himself to the tiniest detail, not just of the music, but of the organization, of everything around it. Are you a control freak?
I'm not a control freak, no, not at all. I just believe that without careful planning and organization, the end result will be less than it could have been. It simply means a devotion to what you do. What is wrong with trying to plan and organize the conditions for the project that you need to realize so that you can produce the best quality you're capable of? Because without that planning, there will be something that will prevent you from achieving the best quality you're able to bring. That would be a pity. So, of course, one needs to have a careful planning. Of course, one has to be precise. How precise do you think were the great, great creators in what they did? Unbelievably precise. They knew exactly what they wanted. If we are to serve them, we can't afford any less precision. We can't afford any less devotion. We can't afford any less preparation and curiosity. If it was so difficult for Beethoven to compose a symphony, why should it be easy for us to perform it?
The reason I ask is just that I wondered whether it might in some way be a reflection of your past experience, that controlling the situation is a reflection of the impotence you felt under the Soviet system and the helplessness against the French unions.
No, I don't believe so, because I don't think I was any different when I was 10 years old. And I was practicing a Beethoven piano sonata, or when I was several years older and I would be preparing a Brahms symphony to conduct. It is not a question of controlling. It has nothing to do with control, because I do realize that lots of things are outside of our control. Circumstances often are of the kind that we cannot control and sometimes should not even control. It's not about control. It's simply about dedication to what you do. And if you do it with other people and they would like to produce the very best of themselves, shouldn't they have similar conditions of being able to produce the best result that they want to produce? There is not a single musician who doesn't want to produce the very best that they're capable of. They need to be helped. It has nothing to do with control. It has everything to do with giving yourself and others who are with you on this an opportunity to do the very best you can do.
You're going to be 60 next year. You've given up all your jobs. Would you be available for another job if it was offered?
You know, it's a very hypothetical discussion.
It isn't. There are two huge vacancies in the States.
No, Boston,
possibly the Met.
It doesn't work like that. Life does not work like that. There is no game plan. There is no situation in which I will say, yes, I'm available. no, I'm not available. You know, it is not something where you come and you send your curriculum vitae and say, I would like to be considered. it just doesn't work like that. Mm. How it works, I can tell you. At this stage of my life, for the first time after 40 years of having been committed to an institution and at some point two institutions, for the first time, I'm only responsible to myself and for myself, for my work. It's an extraordinary feeling. Absolutely extraordinary. And I see it in the way in which I received everywhere I go, because I don't control. I'm not perceived of controlling or dominating anybody's life. I bring them the music, which is dear to me. I give them the very best of myself, and I get back every bit as much as I give, and plenty of affection and plenty of welcome. Absolutely everywhere I go, I receive everywhere exactly the same welcome. And why? And I think I know the answer. I have no luggage.
You're not a threat.
I'm not a threat. I only share with them music. What is important for me about the pieces I conduct, I share it with them, and they're happy to give back. And I get so much, plenty. So the rest of it, minor details.
Semyon Bychkov, thank you very much.
Norman Lebrecht was talking to the conductor, Semyon Bychkov, who makes his first of two appearances at this year's BBC Proms, conducting the Verdi Requiem on Sunday evening. The producer of the Lebrecht interview was Jeremy Evans. And you can get a free download of the programme from the Radio 3 website. Well, Norman's guest next Monday is one of the world's most influential artistic administrators, the president of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, Deborah Border.
Sibelius's last surviving symphony. Bartok's last completed concerto. At the 2011 BBC Proms, Sir Mark Elder and the Halle Orchestra perform works by Sibelius and Janáček, and pianist András Schiff joins them for Bartok's surprisingly lyrical third piano concerto. András Schiff, Mark Elder and the Halle. The BBC Proms on Thursday night at 7:30, live on the home of the BBC Proms, BBC Radio 3.
Well, I've got some piano and orchestral music in just a couple of minutes' time, but first, with mention there of Sibelius, I thought we could hear one of his short humoresques, pieces he composed as he struggled to shape his fifth symphony, in fact. Vilde Frang is the violinist here with the WDR Symphony Orchestra of Cologne.
Thank you.
The first of three humoresques by Sibelius, played there by Wilde Frang, with the WDR Symphony Orchestra of Cologne, conducted by Thomas Sondergaard. The saxophonist and trio player, Steve Lehman, will be the subject of this week's edition of Jazz on 3. They recorded a session for us with the trumpeter Byron Wallen earlier this month. And from New York, you can also hear the band Paradoxical Frog playing at this year's Vision Festival in New York. That's Jazz on 3 at 11 o'clock tonight. Our next programme is the first of our essays this week. It's one of three postcards from the city named after its emperor some 1,600 years ago. It had been known as Byzantium, but from Constantinople it became Istanbul, or Stanbul if you're local. We go back to the classical era tonight in our first essay, when Constantine had embarked upon his great building programme to make that city the great eastern capital of the empire. That's at 10:45. To take us there, a fantasia, not on Byzantine themes, but on Russian folk songs. It's by Anton Arensky. There are two folk tunes, in fact. They're woven together by the pianist here, Stephen Coombs, with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Jerzy Maksymiuk.